Okay, we are getting closer to closing out this week. And today we're gonna be looking back at, of course, yesterday's Robert Mueller testimony to some extent. I have a few thoughts. I mainly wanna get Emma Vigeland's thoughts on that. She's gonna be joining us a little bit later on to break down several different stories that have been developing throughout the day, including yesterday's testimony. We're also gonna be joined by a New York State Senator who's gonna be breaking down the new New York Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, which has some pretty good provisions in it. And so we're gonna be breaking that down, seeing what we might learn from this bill that could potentially be applied to other parts of the country. And you know what, Burke's gonna be joining me in the last block to break down just an like, we deal with a lot of issues of racism here. This one is not like a government official, but it's just someone who's incredibly comfortable in their racist views, increasingly comfortable. Weird that that's developing now. So we're gonna talk about that and see what we can learn from that as well. But why don't we start off and just get out of the way a few of the things that have been frustrating me about the Mueller testimony and Trump in particular. So that's where we're gonna be starting. Yesterday, Mueller testified. I did a little bit of live commentary on it on KTLA. But if you didn't see that, I do wanna fill you in on a few of the things that I was thinking about as it was developing. Perhaps there's some overlap with how you were responding in real time. Just a few things that seem sort of weird about what happened at the testimony, and especially the way that various groups have been spinning what happened. Because it feels like, really deep down, that everyone is being fake and stupid and awful. And that's sort of the theme to the show, but in particular, I wanna focus on this story today. So first, it's this sort of takeaway. Let's take a look at this headline. You've probably seen a lot of these. Trump takes post-Mueller victory lap, which is not wrong, he did do that. But the headline sort of implies that there was a future going into that testimony where he didn't do a victory lap, and that doesn't exist. That's BS, that's simply fake. The headline should be, Trump takes victory lap because you know he was gonna. Because you know that he was gonna. He was obviously going to do that. It doesn't matter what was said there. Like, it wasn't like Mueller was gonna come out and give a serious, respectful but damning account of what Donald Trump did. And Donald Trump would just break down crying in his bedroom in the White House and wouldn't be seen for 72 hours. That wasn't gonna happen. Mueller said a lot of bad stuff that's sort of just been lost in all this because we didn't fundamentally learn anything new. We just relearned all the awful things we already knew. So it didn't matter that Mueller explicitly said that he was not exonerated. Didn't matter. Within an hour or two, Donald Trump was back again to tweeting videos showing that he'd been totally exonerated, no collusion, no obstruction. So it didn't matter that it wasn't a Democrat saying it or a pundit saying it. It was literally Robert Mueller saying it. Didn't matter, so he still had his victory lap, of course. So Mueller implied but didn't state outright that it was now in Congress's hands to do something about the findings if they thought it merited some sort of investigation. We already knew that, but he danced around that topic. It was irrelevant. I mean, Mueller saying and sort of walking back the meaning behind this, but saying that once Donald Trump is no longer president, he could face charges for what was found in the report. Doesn't matter at all. Now, granted, if he gets a second term, then that means the statute of limitations on those particular acts of obstruction of justice would have elapsed at that point. So bear that in mind if you want there to be some sort of consequences. And I honestly think, I don't wanna rain anyone's parade or anything, but I think the idea that a couple of years from now, Donald Trump's gonna leave office and there's gonna be a serious Democrat-led attempt to have him face justice, I just don't think that that's the political world we live in. But all this stuff, and I don't wanna walk through any more of the quotes, because the odds that you're watching this show and you don't already know what was said seems fairly impossible to me. But you know what was said, and you know that he comes out and he says, you're fake news, total exoneration, no collusion. He was always going to say that. And so when like Chuck Todd sees that that's happening, and then he sits at his chair and he says, this was a failure for the Democrats, look at Trump, he feels emboldened. And I saw a headline that was like, Mueller testimony does nothing to move the needle. No momentum. Well, first of all, if there was going to be momentum, we probably wouldn't know yet, obviously. And second of all, it's just a fundamental lie about who exactly needed to be persuaded by the events yesterday. And so that's the second thing that bothers me. Partially because the media doesn't seem to get this, and more importantly, because the Democrats don't seem to get this. The idea was going into this, can the Democrats, with Mueller's help or reluctant help, can they convince enough people that impeachment is warranted? That wasn't what was going on. That wasn't what was going on at all. There might have been some Democrats, even Democrats in that room, that falsely believe that's what was going on. But the only person holding up impeachment proceedings right now is Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi already knew everything that was going to be revealed in yesterday's testimony, and she doesn't care, and she's not going to do anything. If you talk to the people, do people support impeachment right now? Really depends on the poll. Sometimes it's incredibly supportive of impeachment, sometimes not so much. But up until this point, it's largely irrelevant what the people think about that, because the case has not been made for them. All you've had is Republicans attacking the very concept that a Republican could, that a president, actually that's a Freudian slip, but an accurate one, that a Republican could ever be impeached, because of course they supported it in the 90s. Now it's impossible. But the people need to be convinced, not by one day of Robert Mueller talking, but by evidence being presented through the course of impeachment proceedings. Nancy Pelosi says, we can't do that because the people don't support it, and it might cost us in the next election. As if polling right now is the only thing that matters, and impeachment proceedings mean a one-day conversation and a vote. That's not what it is at all. No one except, there was, I think it was Al Green, nobody's saying let's vote on impeachment today. They're saying let's have proceedings, let's have a national conversation about this and see if the evidence warrants impeachment. But Nancy Pelosi wants to put literally a Republican spin on this, to pretend that it's a one-day process so that she can pass the buck and say, no, we're not gonna do anything about it, we're gonna move on to the election. And so all of what we saw yesterday had the impossible task of convincing her to change her mind on that. And it wasn't going to happen. Everybody's pretending that that's not what was going on. That if somehow Robert Mueller had been a little bit more collected and a little bit more assertive in describing the evidence against Trump, that would have convinced some people in a diner in Iowa, and that then impeachment would have become just inevitable. That wasn't what was going to happen. Why is everyone being so fake about this? Another thing that bothered me though, and I do want to turn to, is Robert Mueller. Now, the people, the most ridiculous parodies of the resistance on Twitter who have made Robert Mueller out to be a literal superhero over the past 2 years, that was always a ridiculous idea of who he was. But even the sort of regular, I would say fairly grounded idea of who he was, didn't really bear out yesterday. The idea that at the very least, let's bear in mind he's a Republican, let's bear in mind what he did in the government during the Iraq War, let's understand all of that stuff and keep our expectations in check. At the very least, he's a serious investigator who cares about justice, right? Well, if that's true, that was not on display yesterday. Now, I know that Robert Mueller clearly does not want to weigh in on this. He doesn't want to be the person who pushes us over into impeachment, if that was even possible. But at the very least, he has a responsibility as the head of this investigation to make sure that people understand what they found. And it's clear that people don't understand. That report was 400 and something pages long. Most people read none of it. A lot of people read some of it. Almost nobody read all of it, regardless of what they say. I read parts of it, I didn't read all of it because that would be crazy. And people need to understand what was actually in it, and especially considering the obfuscation that William Barr and Donald Trump purposefully put out ahead of the release of the report, we need someone who can explain what's in it. Not to make the case for impeachment or anything like that, but to explain the thinking behind what ended up in the finalized report. And he just did not feel that responsibility. He believes that this meddling is still going on and poses a grave threat. He very briefly touched on that, but he didn't make real the threat. He didn't make real how insane it is that the Republicans don't care about it. He had no passion whatsoever. He just didn't feel like it was on him to respond to these sorts of things. The strategy that we saw yesterday, where Republicans just took turns throwing conspiracy theories at him, he felt like, well, I don't want to get involved. And so those conspiracy theories simply stayed. They weren't rebutted. He didn't say that it was a mischaracterization in all cases. And so many of them got to have their soundbite, and that's it. That's not objectivity. Like, you're not answering it, but that doesn't mean that you've done your job. It doesn't mean it's on the Democrats or on other pundits to rebut them. You did this investigation, you're the face of it. Whether you ever wanted to be or not, you have a responsibility. I would say a moral obligation to make sure that people don't believe crazy things. You don't have to make the Democratic case for impeachment, but you do have to respond to conspiracy theories when they're thrown in your face. And he chose not to do that. And finally, and perhaps most quickly, the fact that this entire thing passed, everybody's focused on the optics of it. Everybody's focused on whether a needle moved or not. And everybody is pretending that impeachment is the only possible consequence. Whether it happens or not, that's the consideration. Whereas on the other side, we have continued foreign intervention in our elections that is very starkly laid out, very clearly laid out in the Mueller report, and everybody just forgot about and nobody cares about. Mueller brought it up very briefly. It was ostensibly literally the subject of the second half of yesterday's proceedings. But is that really the impression you got, that this is a serious problem, that everybody, okay, we may think differently about impeachment, but we're all serious about protecting our democracy? I didn't get that at all. And the Democrats didn't put enough pressure on the Republicans, considering how much they've been defending the people who've been stonewalling any progress in this area. Just yesterday, right after the testimony, Democrats tried to get consent to pass two bills that would require campaigns to alert the FBI and the FEC about foreign offers of assistance, as well as a bill to let the Senate Sergeant at Arms offer voluntary cyber assistance for personal devices and accounts of senators and staff. Republican Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith blocked each of the bills. She didn't give reasons for objections, or say if she was objecting on behalf of herself or the Senate GOP caucus. People reached out to her spokesperson and they didn't leave any sort of comment. And so she was able to block actual nobody says that they're against that. But clearly some people are. And they also feel comfortable being against it without ever having to go on the record as to why. She just blocked it and that's it. No pressure on her. We request comment. She doesn't give it. And then she just goes on about her day, because they get to pretend that they care about protecting our country without ever having to do the work of actually doing it. And the pundits don't care. They're not focusing on this. The Democrats have their strategy for whatever that is, but it ignores this component almost entirely. It is simply madness. And I'm still trying to put together the pieces. Okay, we have to move on. We're going to touch on this topic again with Emma in just a little bit. We're going to take a break and come back, talk about the climate breakdown.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today, and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
I noticed a couple of pieces of news this morning concerning climate change. This sort of concerned me. The first was that the sections of the Russian Arctic are on fire, and it's so widespread at this point that you can see the clouds of smoke from space. And I guess if you'd asked me when I was a kid if the Arctic being constantly on fire would be enough to get people to take climate breakdown seriously, I would have guessed yes, but I was naive. I was young. I also saw that the scientific certainty that humans are causing climate change has now ticked up to 99%. And I thought, oh, good, that'll convince the Republicans. But anyway, it's obviously a serious problem. Even like casually checking the news in the morning convinces you of that. And while there are a lot of politicians in our country that are not taking it seriously, thankfully there are some plans to do something about it. One of those is the New York Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. And joining us now to talk about it is Senator Todd Kominski. Todd, welcome to the show.
It's an important topic, so thank you.
Thank you. I could not agree more. And so for people outside of New York who might not be familiar with it, could you break down in broad strokes what the bill is intended to do?
Sure. So with Washington really asleep at the switch, New York, which is a pretty consequential economy, you know, bigger than some countries, we decided this year that we were going to do our own greenhouse gas reduction comprehensive climate bill. And what the bill largely does is say that our electricity generation sector in New York will be carbon free by 2040, and that economy wide, New York will have a carbon neutral economy by 2050. That means that we will not be adding any more carbon to the atmosphere as of 2050. That means how we, you know, our modes of transportation, our buildings, our factories, and of course, where we get our power from. So it's extremely sweeping, but we thought that this type of measure was necessary and that in this era, unfortunately, states have to lead. It would be much easier if the federal government did this. We wouldn't have to worry about states competing against one another for different jobs. But we want to be first movers. New York wants to be on the ground floor of a new green economy, and we're really excited to get started.
Well, that's good to hear. And as you point out, New York, obviously a very important state, big population, big economy. The task of getting to net zero is going to be difficult in 2050. It is ambitious, although there are environmentalists that think that that might not be fast enough. But even so, it's going to be a complex task. So what are some of the ways that you're going to, in the areas of energy production, transportation, how are you going to try to achieve that by the middle of the century?
So one of the first things we set out to do was make sure that we have the best expertise possible making these decisions. So there's going to be something called a Climate Action Council that's going to be figuring out how to get us from here to there. And within that, there'll be subgroups from different industries or in different subcategories like transportation or housing that are going to help try to figure this out. But it's really important when we do this to realize that certain disadvantaged communities that frankly have been dumped on too long really need to be at the forefront in terms of benefiting from this and make sure that they're, you know, actually more than just included. And this law does that in a number of ways. And it also aims to make sure that we're retraining workers and have the workforce of the new green economy moving forward. We want New York to be the locus of that important new technology. There are going to be people that are going to have to learn to assemble wind turbines, who are going to have to help build transmission lines, who are going to have to help build community solar. And we want New Yorkers to be trained in doing this. The governor, working together with the legislature, really smartly put a program together with our universities that are going to begin that training. And I think being first movers here is very important. And we hope to lead by example. You will get exponentially more benefit from this if states, especially in the neighboring regions, begin to want to do this too. And of course, you won't have to worry about having, competitive states taking, you know, business one from another. If we're all on the same energy page, so to speak, it works out better for everybody.
So look, I think you're in attempting to sell this bill, get people enthused about the changes that it's going to necessitate. You have, like, you know, environmentalists that obviously have a certain set of concerns. And then you have regular people who might not think about it very much. From the standpoint of a regular person who might be living in, you know, somewhere in New York or New York City, how is this going to impact them in, you know, 30 years? What are they going to notice that might be different as a result of this bill?
Well, first thing, I do believe that a lot of people, especially where I am on the South Shore of Long Island, where Hurricane Sandy devastated, are really starting to appreciate climate change. You know, you turn on TV, California's on fire. Farmers in the Midwest are flooded off their farms. We've had major storms that people, you know, my grandma bought her house in Long Beach where I live in the mid-century, never had a drop of water in her basement until Hurricane Sandy put 5 feet of water in her basement.
Wow.
So
wow.
People are waking up to this, and especially the younger generations really get it. That being said, this is gonna have material impacts on the way people live. The cars they drive will not have combustions anymore. Their homes will be heated and cooled with totally different energy sources. So we have to make this very attractive to people and have a broad education campaign to let people know what benefits are going to be available, you know, in the mid part of the next decade that are going to want people to make these changes. This is economy wide. This is going to affect every New Yorker in the way we get from here to there, in the way we live in our homes, the office buildings we go to, et cetera. We just want to make this as much a joint effort. And as the prices of these new technologies come down, as this becomes more widely used, as the government figures out a plan, we in New York to incentivize people to do this. This is all totally possible. And that was what my mission was over the last year. How possible is this? And we do believe 2040 for our electricity sector, getting it to carbon zero is possible. We do believe, after talking to scientists and concerned people who have expert opinions on this, that we can be carbon neutral in our economy by 2050, but it's going to take some really smart planning and having everyone in the public wanting to do this. And we believe we can get there. And this Climate Action Council, along with our legislature and governor, will have to work to do that.
Well, obviously an incredibly important issue. So thank you for working on a bill to address it. People are going to need to be educated on it and also keep it in the front of their mind. And to the extent that we here at the Young Turks and the Damage Report can do that, we would love to help. Senator Todd Kominski, thank you for joining us today. We're going to take a short break here. We come back, we're going to be breaking down the news of the day with Emma Vigeland. So we have got Emma Vigeland joining us from New York. Emma, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
I want to start off by talking about the big story of yesterday, and that would of course be Robert Mueller's testimony before two different House committees. Before we get into sort of the fallout, going into it, look, everybody had their own expectations, but I am curious, what were you thinking would come of it before he actually testified?
What was I thinking about?
Like, what did you expect would happen on that day? How did you think it would be spinned? What were your expectations going into what was being pitched as a major news event?
Yeah, so honestly, I was very bored by the entire speculation about it. I did not think that much was going to come out of it. Robert Mueller said not much was going to come out of it. He was just going to refer everyone to the report, and that's exactly what he did over and over. It seemed really like a calculated political stunt on Nancy Pelosi's part, because everything he was going to say was already in the report. And really, it was just an effort for her to continue stalling on impeachment and also allow sound bites to get into the news so it would be heard from the horse's mouth. And that's exactly what happened. But it backfired in a lot of ways, because it seemed like to Republicans and to conservatives that he was stonewalling, because when Republicans were going in on him and hammering him over and over, he just couldn't say. So the optics worked both ways, and I think it was tilted slightly in the Republicans' favor, unfortunately.
Okay, so I want to return to the Republican strategy in a second, but let's start off, because you mentioned that you think it was a calculated stunt, not by like the Democrats, but by Nancy Pelosi, having to do with impeachment. Now, the Republican theory is that she really does want impeachment, and she's playing eight-dimensional chess as a way to get there. It seems like neither of us believe that that's true. So if this was a strategy and she doesn't want impeachment, was the strategy to have this fail and derail conversation around impeachment right now?
That would be very Machiavellian in a way that I don't think Pelosi is capable of. What's frustrating to me is there's this like fetishization in the media of politicians. So they pretend like or think that, you know, Trump is always playing 27-dimensional chess and he's pulling puppet strings, when in reality these are just human beings and they're pretty much as transparent as the rest of us. This isn't a house of cards come to life. This is actually real life. And so usually their motivations, if you're paying any attention, are pretty obvious. So I don't think that Pelosi is doing anything to move impeachment forward. In fact, I think she wants the political ramifications of the potential of an impeachment, of the American public believing that Donald Trump did something wrong, without having to actually impeach. Because for many reasons, one, Trump is good for fundraising for her, and two, she is in the brand of Democrats that is so shell-shocked by Reagan and by what happened during the Clinton presidency and the backlash that the Republicans got from trying to impeach him in an entirely different circumstance, that she truly has internalized this idea that impeachment would be the death of the Democrats in 2020, when in reality this is just another part of her leadership, which is weakness and fecklessness. And so that's really what she personifies when you're looking at her Democratic leadership. So this isn't again, you know, this larger strategy. This is just a part of who she is as a Democratic leader, and that is someone who is beholden to donors and someone who believes in the politics of old, and the politics of old are don't rock the boat as a Democrat, or the Reagan Republicans are going to slam you in the elections, mm-hmm. and they're the strong party, and we have to be the weak party. And people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib don't play by those rules.
You raised a couple of points that I want to address. So I largely agree with you about what Nancy Pelosi wants to happen over the next year and a half. But think about, we really do need to get better at identifying people for whom all of this thing that we dwell in every day, for some it's like a hobby slash their career, and for other people it's real life. Like, she wants to raise money off of him and thinks that like a year and a half from now it'll help by a point or two in the election. But the downside of the plan, even if she gets her way, is that he remains in power. And he does a travel ban against Guatemala, which we're just reading he's gonna do. Maybe they execute a few people. Maybe we start a war with Iran. Like, all of those consequences, that's real world stuff. We don't need to worry about that. We got political considerations to keep in mind.
Yeah, that's such a great point, John, and it's so true, because really, you know, I just saw that this is a now deleted tweet, but she was at some cocktail party with Maureen Dowd, New York Times columnist, last night, right after this happened. Everything's hunky-dory because this is a political game to these people. And while Pelosi's heart is in a better place than, you know, like Paul Ryan or past speakers of the House, whatever, Kevin McCarthy, I'm not going to equivocate and say they're the same kind of person, but it is a game, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what happens when you're in Washington for this long, when you play by these corrupt rules. The consequences of what you're doing feel very foreign to you, and it seems more just like days at the office and political games that you're playing with your coworkers, and everyone gets along. But the consequences of this are far-reaching, especially the notion that the most powerful person in the world is above the law.
Yeah.
And that's the notion that she's perpetuating. And I don't know how she can look at young kids in this country who want to and say, you know, we live by these universal ideals, these constitutional ideals, and still not hold the person accountable who needs to be held accountable.
Well, I won't make you suffer through talking more about yesterday's testimony. I'm sure you've had to think about it quite enough. We are gonna take a short break, but if you'll stick around, a couple other big pieces of news, including some progress in Puerto Rico, we'll be breaking down after this break.
People you see erupting in celebration on the streets of San Juan.
This is amazing. This is what we all wanted.
So there you have, as they say, people in the streets of San Juan celebrating because, seemingly against all odds, Governor Ricardo Rossello is going to be stepping down on August 2nd, announcing, despite the mandate I was given by the public that elected me democratically, today I feel that continuing in this position could make it difficult for the success reached to continue. No reference there to the various scandals and corruption and all of that. But Emma, we've been watching this, you know, for a little while now, and we've seen these historic protests developing. And I don't know about you, but I feel so beaten down by everything that's been happening here, you know, continental-wise, that it seems impossible that the people could get their way, and yet this happened. Did this shock you too?
Yeah, so I mean, for the first time in the hundreds of years of Puerto Rico's existence, they have forced out a sitting governor without an election. Mm-hmm. And there have been hundreds of governors, which is incredible. I mean, first, you know, appointed by the United States. Before that, they were under colonial rule. I mean, I think it's only been about 60 years where Puerto Ricans have had the ability to democratically elect their governor, which is incredible. And so they forced out Rossello, and now I believe Wanda Vasquez, I'm forgetting her last name, is going to take over. And so she's the justice secretary. And it really is going to be about how Puerto Ricans respond and who they want to put in place, how they can recover from this. Because we see internationally, leaders are forced out all of the time due to popular protests, or not all of the time, but when it does happen, it's enormously significant. And sometimes the outcomes aren't better than what happened before. So Puerto Ricans have to be really smart and really diligent, but they should be celebrating today because what they've done is historic and goes to show that Puerto Rico just continues to realize its political power. The Puerto Rican people are starting to just kind of have this renaissance of political self-determination and excitement. And it's really awesome to see. And the United States has to reckon with its colonial relationship with Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. The fact that we are implemented these austerity measures on the island, which have only worsened the problem and were the beginning of many of these protests starting in 2016. And a lot of that is wrapped into the fury that Puerto Rican people are feeling. So we have to see, you know, ask ourselves in our government, how can we be constructive here? How can we give Puerto Rico political power? How can we make sure that the debt is taken care of and not in a way that just like ensures that bankers get repaid, but that actually Puerto Rican people reap the benefits of the debt being repaid?
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you pointed out all the ways that not only were they devastated by the hurricane and the completely mismanaged, the tragically and life or death mismanagement of the recovery from it, but they're still worse off and probably will continue to be worse off than they were before because the US seemingly doesn't care to help. You pointed out obviously the legacy of colonialism and it seems like there's a chance that their energy sector might end up being even more corrosive in its impact on the environment and economically than it was previously. A measurable percentage of their population left and will never return. The actual demographics of the island have changed perhaps irreparably. And so I wonder, on the island, the people have done what they need to do, but is it time for them to no longer be separated? But can the separation between the rest of the US and Puerto Rico continue if Puerto Rico is to actually recover from what happened?
Yeah, I mean, that is what is going to have to be reckoned with in the coming weeks, months, years. I believe that Puerto Rico needs infinitely more independence. The fact that it's only been X number of decades, 6 decades, that they've been able to determine who is the governor of their island is an absolute travesty. And they are consistently treated as second-class citizens. And the fact that it's not recognized in the public discourse that we have a colonial relationship still with Puerto Rico, and we are a nation that was founded against colonialism, and the supreme irony of that is astounding to me. And Puerto Rico is as much of a part of the United States as the 50 other states, and we need to start treating it as such, because otherwise now Puerto Rico just becomes a tax haven for big pharma companies, for rich people, for tech bros, for these cryptocurrency companies, all of that. And they reap the opposite of benefits corporate greed and then don't get the benefits. So
yeah, the cost and the drawbacks.
The drawbacks. Thank you. My mind is scrambled eggs today. So yeah, that's what we have to avoid, and that's what's been the reality for a really long time.
Okay, and look, if that was to be undertaken, that some sort of change, that relationship, that would of course have to be initiated by them. It would have to be up to the people of Puerto Rico. But I know that obviously there'd be a great deal of opposition to that from Republicans here. I don't know exactly why. There's some reason they don't want it to become a state. I don't know, maybe someone will figure it out someday. But with that, why don't we turn to another story? There's this guy, Jeffrey Epstein. I'm not sure if you've heard about him, and there's a development with him. So Jeffrey Epstein wanted to be out on bail, but he is being held. And there was a development today where he was found, they say, in the fetal position in his cell with injuries to his neck. And it's not clear to jail officials yet if the injuries, which apparently occurred on Tuesday, were self-inflicted or the result of an assault. Epstein told authorities he was beaten up and called a child predator, according to sources. He has been placed on suicide watch, although his injuries are described as not serious. The Federal Bureau of Prisons, citing privacy and security concerns, declined to comment on the matter. And because they won't say much, and there's these conflicting accounts, there are theories going around about exactly what happened to him. Now, I realize that we can do virtually nothing but speculate at this point. But based on this news, Emma, what's your read on what might be happening here?
We don't know, I guess. I mean, we don't know if they were self-inflicted. We don't know if he was beat up. It's hard for me to care. I'm trying my best. Look, I mean, this man, the fact that he wanted to be out on bail, it's natural. I guess that's what's pushed by everyone's lawyers. But the fact of the matter is that if there's someone in the world who doesn't deserve to be on bail, it's like number one, El Chapo, and then number two, Jeffrey Epstein. And I think they're being held in the same prison in New York, by the way. But Jeffrey Epstein, despite being caught and being sentenced to prison where he could leave 6 out of the 7 days to go to his very important job of hedge funding, it has then, after he got out of jail and he ended his 13-month sentence, he just did the same stuff that he did before of child rape, child trafficking, all of the horrific, horrific crimes. He didn't learn one thing, allegedly. He continued to do those things after he received his punishment. So what's to say if he was let out on bail that he wouldn't do the same thing over and over again? So the fact that he's being held is very important. This is a man who has never received even close to an iota of the punishment that he should for his horrific actions that are exploitative, disgusting. I mean, every thesaurus for gross, just look that up. That's everything that he's done. So, I'm just happy that he's being held in prison. Beef up the security, guys, because I want him desperately to stand in court and have to face the consequences of his egregious actions.
Yeah, and my final point here, and you know, I don't want to go off into crazy territory. This isn't InfoWars. But while you want him to stand in trial and evidence to come out and all of that, there are people that don't. You know, he is well connected, and some of those people know what they did. And so, look, whether he theoretically could be like pushed to commit suicide, or if he could actually be assaulted, this is a really high-profile prisoner. If they're not watching to see if someone is assaulting and potentially could kill him, I mean, you kind of have to wonder, that's sort of willful lack of interest in what's going on. You know that this guy is going to be a target. You know that there's a lot of people who do not want him to live to make it to trial. I mean, you can't simply stand by and say, well, what do you know? He was in the shower and someone punched him in the neck. That feels a little bit too convenient at this point, although I don't want to go off in any crazy territory.
Yeah, thank you, Alex John Iderola Jones. No, I mean, I agree with you, though. We can never, never underestimate the reach of powerful people. And Jeffrey Epstein is certainly a powerful person who's surrounded by even more powerful people. So yeah, that's an important point when we're looking at this case, because that's what's informed the entire lack of justice surrounding the case is power. Yeah. And money.
And money. And he certainly got a lot of that too. Emma, as always, thank you for joining us. Everybody check out Emma's work. It's consistently awesome. And so I'd highly recommend you do that. Have a good rest of your day.
Thanks, John. You too.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, Brooke is going to be joining us to break down a truly horrendous story after this. So that's footage from a North Carolina Bonefish Grill, which I believe is not representative of the experience you get there at what must be a very high quality fish restaurant. But that was Nancy Goodman speaking. That name also not representative of the content of her character. But what we've got there is this woman who is assailing two women who made the unfortunate mistake of being black in public.
Right, exactly.
Who were at a bar and were drinking and eating, and this woman didn't like it.
Right.
And decided to accost them. We're going to show you more footage, okay, but so you found this story.
Yeah, I saw it last night. Yeah,
probably hardly a shock, I suppose.
You know, completely not a shock. Her reaction to it, her response, which I know you're going to get to later, was surprising. Not that she felt it, but that she was fine being open and honest about it, you know? And that was surprising because people usually hide when they're shamed. They don't necessarily change, but they kind of, you know, stand down a little bit.
Yeah, we're gonna see if there might be any change. But first, let's show you like a longer section of the altercation. Now, understand that the video you're about to see comes, she had already been talking to these women and telling them they're too loud, they're rude, and all of
that. She was trying to police two grown women at a bar, which I want you to pay attention to. Just note how loud the music is in the background, because a lot of times people think that there are reasons for this or she had a valid concern, when what I just want everybody to understand is that some racist monsters just like policing black people. That's it. Mm-hmm. It's not about a valid concern. Everyone can say like, oh, but I don't like when people are loud, blah, blah, blah. No, what it comes down to is people like policing black people. Mm-hmm. That's just it, because they are at a bar and it's loud and I don't wanna.
Exactly. Well, you know what? A video is worth a thousand words, yes, as good as your words are. So here is some more of what happened.
We paying for our food just like everybody else. And she told us that we are the rudest people ever. So here's the thing. Here's the thing. What you gotta understand is that you don't know what people going through. Okay, you wanna come over here? You wanna
come? She ain't gonna come over here.
Yes, she will. Yes, she will.
So here's the thing. Let me understand.
We're too loud.
We're too loud. In your opinion. Let me show you my money. It's just as green as yours.
Right. Oh, you're so stupid.
Stupid? Oh! No.
So call your black friends a call your black friends a
so she basically just called us a
that you still call y'all a
not like you.
Okay, so I know that looks bad, but they asked her why she did that, and she said that she suffers from anxiety and that the situation was out of my control.
No, they also, she
so
also,
that's an explanation. So do you accept her apology that she didn't give?
She also said that she knew it was offensive, and that's specifically why she said it to them. Mm-hmm. She essentially said they deserved it. And what matters here is that you cannot police other grown people, and it is a racist trope to go up and tell black people to be quiet. Mm-hmm. This stereotype that black women are louder than any man ever, mm-hmm, which is never true. Mm-hmm. It's what
Look
you see
Gates,
and what you hear.
Yesterday.
It is this idea that black women are aggressive and angry, and so when they're having fun, you gotta be scared. Mm-hmm. When they're having fun, you gotta make it stop. They are at a bar. People actually punch other people at bars, okay?
You
bars rough
get bars.
Crazy. I don't, but it's just, well, you know, things, crazy things happen at bars. It gets loud at bars. People get drunk at bars. Mm-hmm. These are two grown women. They're not doing anything illegal. They're not punching anybody. They're not, they were having fun. And yeah, she felt the need to get up and go over and reprimand them and embarrass them and basically say that you're too loud for my liking.
Well,
which
let's show how comfortable she was, because okay, she said it in public, mm-hmm, while she was being filmed, mm-hmm, which is already like, you're pretty comfortable, right, using that language. But then when she was asked about it, she said, I'm not gonna say I'm sorry to them because they kept pushing at it. I would say it again to them. She said this to the news. She was on video having used the N-word and then doubles down on the news. Now, supposedly she posted something on Facebook saying she was ashamed. I don't have access to her Facebook. And I don't really care about her.
You don't really want it, right?
After what she's done. But she wasn't ashamed for a really long time.
She called these two people rude. The woman who yells out stupid N-word in the middle of a restaurant, in the middle of the day with that haircut, has the nerve to call somebody else rude.
That's ridiculous. So two other thoughts I have. One, as I watch this woman get in her face and then yell a racial slur, I thought, and I know I say this a lot on the show, we're never getting to Star Trek, man. It's just not happening for the human race. We're not gonna sail amongst the stars because we're yelling at each other in fish bars.
How does everything
but the
come
second
down
thing,
to some sort of no, sci-fi television
sometimes
show?
It comes down to Game of Thrones. The other thing is, take a look at this. This is a screenshot from a Fox News article about this.
Okay.
Nancy Goodman, whose use of the N-word was reportedly caught on cell phone video. That screenshot I took was from their article. It was above the video embedded where she uses the N-word. They wouldn't even simply state the fact that she did it in an article where they show her doing it. They still have to hide
reportedly
behind. Reportedly, people are saying she said it.
Okay,
she said it.
Right.
God, people are cowards. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us. We only have a couple seconds.
Okay,
great to have you
me
here.
Always glad to jump in.
Always glad to have you here. Thank you, everybody, for watching. We'll be here tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.